Now, where we left off in our last session was a discussion of the emerging practical Zionist. You recall Theodor Herzl, pretty much the father of Zionism, but he had a very intellectual and a strategic sort of view. It took practical Zionists like Chaim Weizmann to really get some colonization going in what we were calling Palestine at the time. And he did this under the auspices of the Zionist organization. But they were really small. But after 1911, when the practical Zionists really took over this movement, the colonization finally expanded. And while of the 85,000 Jews that were in Palestine in 1914, only 30 to 35,000 of them were immigrants from the post-1880 period. There were more immigrants, though, in 1914 than any previous year, and the work had begun on specific Jewish institutions like the Haifa Technikon and even the planning of the Hebrew University. Now, what changed the situation and brought Zionism into the sphere of practical politics, in other words, trying to get something done instead of just talking about it, was the entry of Turkey into the First World War against the Allies. Now, on November the 9th, 1914, Asquith, who was the British Prime Minister, made a speech at the Lord Mayor's banquet. He announced the Turkish Empire has committed suicide. Palestine, like the rest of the Ottoman Turkish Empire, now became a target for dividing their territory among the Allies after their expected World War I victory. Now, you got to remember now that the Ottoman Turkish Empire was the last caliphate that the Muslims had that was organized and successful. Now, in January of 1915, Herbert Samuel, who was a member of the British cabinet, he circulated a memorandum to his colleagues on the future of Palestine. And in the course of writing it, he modified his advocacy of a Jewish state to admit that the time was not yet ripe for it. But he looked forward to an independent Palestine. So, in other words, he was slowing the process down. Now, there were, of course, many counter-political arguments to British championing of Zionism, but the keen awareness of arguments in favor of Zionism motivated Chaim Weizmann to push the case for Zionism into some pretty influential British government circles. And indeed, Weizmann fed the material regarding this to the British Cabinet Secretariat. Now, we have to remember that Weizmann was very influential. He was a chemist, and he had developed some acetone, I believe it was, which was used in warfare in the First World War. British government took it right in. Now, there were two separate groups in this Anglo-Jewry fighting for the attention of the British government. On the one hand, there was the official community that was represented by a group called the Conjoint Foreign Committee of the Board of Deputies, and then this Anglo-Jewish Association. Now, their secretary from 1914 was a guy named Lucien Wolff, and he was the leading expert, so-called, on Jewish diplomacy in the fight for Jewish rights in Europe. And on the other hand, there was Weizmann's small group and some Zionist associates and sympathizers, including people in some real key positions in the government. Now, since it was always the pride of the Anglo-Jewish establishment that they were a key influence with the government, it proved a humiliating disappointment that Weizmann, remember now, he's a Russian Jew, and he'd been a resident only about 10 years in Britain, that he outmaneuvered them. So in 1914, the Conjoint Committee, which consisted of 14 members from the two constituent bodies, was prepared to do anything to protect the rights of oppressed or underprivileged Jews abroad. Interestingly, the committee was opposed to Zionism as a movement. That threatened the emancipation of Jews as individuals in their countries of residence. Now, from 1914 and 1915, the Conjoint Committee treated the Zionists with condescension. They just looked down on them. The Conjoint Committee did not know that Weizmann was having regular meetings with members of the government, the high-level government, such as Samuel, the Member of Parliament, and Balfour, the Foreign Secretary, and Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, and that Samuel had circulated his memorandum on Zionism in January of 1915. Now, the Conjoint Committee saw as its principal objective the amelioration of the position of the Jews of Russia. Meanwhile, Weizmann had been working on the British government to secure a declaration that would be favorable to Zionism. He also sought support within the Anglo-Jewish establishment. It's not clear when Walter, the second Lord Rothschild, MP and a financier, became a Zionist, but it was certainly not later in 1915 when he succeeded his father, Charles, the younger brother of Walter, also became a convinced Zionist. Now, the Conjoint Committee realized real early in 1917 that it was being outmaneuvered by Weizmann and Samuel in its quest to influence the British government at the highest level. The realization was confirmed, though, when the Foreign Secretary twice hinted in May of 1917 that it would deprecate any action by the committee to engage the public controversy against Zionism. So on June 19, 1917, Lord Rothschild, very, very wealthy man, and Weizmann saw Balfour, and Rothschild told Balfour that the majority of the British Jews were in favor of a national home. Well, Rothschild was asked by Balfour for a draft declaration that was sent a month later on the 18th of July of 1917. This is why the declaration written by Lord Balfour, when ultimately approved by the War Cabinet, was solely addressed to Lord Rothschild. Well, the British Cabinet made its decision on October 31st of that year to issue a declaration. The determining factors were not the opinions of British Jews, but the supposed impact on Jews in Russia, America, and elsewhere. What they said was, if we could make a declaration favorable to such an idea, we should be able to carry on useful propaganda both in Russia and America. Well, you know, Balfour did mention in general terms the objection, because he said the difficulty felt with regard to the future position of the Jews in Western country. But he rejected it, and the Secretary of State was authorized to take a suitable opportunity of making the following declaration of sympathy with Zionist aspirations. Even Weizmann in 1918, writing to Ormsby Gore, who was then with the Zionist Commission in Tel Aviv, stated, "We consider a British Palestine and a Jewish Palestine practically identical, in that in working for a Jewish Palestine, we will at the same time be working for a British Palestine. We do not consider any other solution, such as, for instance, a Jewish state, satisfactory or possible." Now, in such circumstances, it's not surprising that by April of 1919, Lucy and Wolf, as secretary of the Joint Foreign Committee, could bring to the attention of the Paris Peace Conference a statement on Palestine agreed by both the Board of Deputies and the Anglo-Jewish Association. Now, that was which was accepted. They accepted the Balfour Declaration, subject only to the proviso that it must not be held to imply that Jews constitute a separate political nationality all over the world, or that the Jewish citizens of countries outside of Palestine owe political allegiance to the government of that country. Now, we have to bear in mind what the Paris Peace Conference was. This was a conference after the First World War where all the Allied nations got together to determine what were they going to do to Germany, how were they going to stop Germany from future aggression. This acceptance of the declaration that was accompanied by a growth of real popular support for Zionism within Anglo Jewry. You know, the membership of the English Zionist Federation, that I'm going to use the letters from now on, EZF, it rose from around 4,000 in 1917 to over 30,000 in 1921. Now, there was a position by the EZF to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 asking for the implementation of the Balfour Declaration to reconstitute Palestine as the Jews' national home. And it was signed by some 77,000 Jews in the United Kingdom out of a total Jewish population of probably less than 300,000. So the Balfour Declaration of 1917 was one more British governmental edict whereby the Jews became one step closer to having a national homeland. Now, it's important that we revisit this issue of the Paris Peace Conference because all the Allied nations were there. So anything that was presented there, especially by the Brits, who were very, very influential, was going to be seriously considered. And that's exactly what happened. Now, Winston Churchill has always been a friend of the Jews. And he said that once British General Allenby marched into Jerusalem in 1914, the British officially had control of Palestine and exert and just substantial influence in the way it was going to be occupied and administered. So the First World War had a tremendous influence in bringing the Jews back to their land. Now, I want to talk about the wrath prophesied before the wrath. In 1933, an Austrian man named Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, and he quickly outmaneuvered his rivals by removing the conservatives from any real participation in government. And by July 1933, he had abolished free trade unions, eliminated the communists, the social democrats, and the Jews from any role in political life, as well as sweeping his opponents into concentration camps. The first one that he set up was in 1933, and it was Dachau, just south of Munich. He staged a fire at their congress, if you will. It's called the Reichstag. And there was a fire there in February the 27th of 33. Now, let's think about this now. He'd only been the chancellor for a month, and they staged the fire, provided him with the perfect pretext to begin consolidating the beginnings of a totalitarian one-party state. And that gave him the ability to have special enabling laws. What these types of politicians do is they create a disaster, and then, which is a straw man, really, and then say, we got this problem, now we have to solve it. So then they'll take away people's rights. Now, these enabling laws, if you will, were ramrodded through the Reichstag to legalize the regime's intimidating tactics under the guise of protecting the nation from terrorist attacks like the Reichstag fire. He got support from the nationalists, too, and Hitler gained a majority at the last democratic elections that were ever held in Germany on March the 5th, 33. And he had exceptional skill. He was very persuasive. He had good propaganda. He implemented terror and intimidation, and he secured power. You know, the seductive notions of national awakening and legal revolution, these things helped to paralyze any political opposition and disguise the reality of autocratic power behind a facade of some traditional institution. Let me say that again. He paralyzed any opposition and he disguised what he was really doing, the nefarious activities he was really doing about collecting all the power, concentration of power. And he was an autocrat, but he had this facade of a traditional institution. A traditional institution. He promised to fundamentally make over their country from its evil status run by what he called the November criminals. And that's how he referred to the German politicians of the Weimar Republic. Those are the ones that signed the Treaty of Versailles at the Paris Peace Conference there, surrendering their sovereignty at the end of the World War I. You know, the destruction of the radical SA, that was Hitler's personal army, his leadership under a guy named Ernst Röhm in the blood purge of June 1934, it was called the Night of the Long Knives, confirmed Hitler as an undisputed dictator of the Third Reich. In other words, he took his personal army, and after he got power, he had them killed off. At the beginning of August, when he united the positions of Führer and Chancellor on the death of von Hindenburg, who was the president, he had all the powers of the state in his hand. Hitler allowed terrible subordinates like Heinrich Himmler, Hermann Göring, and Joseph Goebbels just to mark out their domains of arbitrary power. And they avoided any institutionalization of authority and status that could challenge their own disputed positions as the supreme arbiters. They had total power, and the people gave it to them. Now, there was a conference of ministers was held on August the 20th, 1935, to discuss the economic effects of party actions against the Jews. Adolf Wagner, the party's representative at the conference, argued that such actions would cease once the government decided on a firm policy against the Jews. They had this continual issue that they raised, the question of the Jew, because Hitler blamed everything that had happened in Germany after the First World War on the Jews. Now, the following month, two measures were announced at the annual party rally in Nuremberg, and that became known as the Nuremberg Laws. Now, both measures were hastily improvised. There was even a shortage of drafting paper, so that the menu cards there had to be used. And Jewish experts, quote, from the Ministry of the Interior were ordered to Nuremberg by plane. Now, the first law was called the Law of the Protection of German Blood and German Honor, prohibited marriages and extramarital intercourse between Jews, the name now officially used in place of non-Aryans, which they used to call them, and Germans, and also the employment of German females under 45 in Jewish households. So, the Law for the Protection of German Blood and German Honor, September the 15th, 1935. Now, I'm going to read these articles for you, and if this doesn't send a chill down your spine, I don't know what will. Article 1. 1. Marriages between Jews and citizens of German or kindred blood are forbidden. Marriages concluded in defiance of this law are void, even if for the purpose of evading this law they were concluded abroad. 2. Public proceedings for annulment may be initiated only by the public prosecutor. Section 2. Sexual relations outside of marriage between Jews and nationals of German or kindred blood are forbidden. Section 3. Jews will not be permitted to employ female citizens of German or kindred blood as domestic servants. Section 4. Number 1. Jews are forbidden to display the Reich and national flag or the national colors. 2. On the other hand, they are permitted to display the Jewish colors. The exercise of this right is protected by the state. Section 5. A person who acts contrary to the prohibition of Section 1 will be punished with hard labor. A person who acts contrary to the prohibition of Section 2 will be punished with imprisonment or hard labor. A person who acts contrary to the provision of Section 3 or 4 will be punished with imprisonment up to a year and with a fine or with one of these penalties. Now, number 6, the Reich Minister of the Interior, in agreement with the Deputy Fuhrer of the Reich Minister of Justice, will issue the legal and administrative regulations required for the enforcement and supplementing of this law. Section 7, the law will become effective on the day after its promulgation. Section 3, however, not until the 1st of January, 1936. Now, they came up with a second law, too, which is even worse than the first one. And all of these enabled the Nazis to start persecuting the Jews. The second one was called the Reich Citizenship Law, and it stripped the Jews of their German citizenship, and it introduced a brand new distinction between Reich citizens and nationals. I'm going to read that for you, too. It's called the Reich Citizenship Law. Now, that came about on September the 15th, 1933. Article 1. 1. A subject of the state is a person who belongs to the protective union of the German Reich and who, therefore, has particular obligations towards the Reich. 2. The status of subject is acquired in accordance with the provisions of the Reich and state law of citizenship. Article 2. A citizen of the Reich is that subject only who is of German or kindred blood and who, through his conduct, shows that he is both desirous and fit to serve the German people and Reich faithfully. 2. The right to citizenship is acquired by the granting of Reich citizenship papers. 3. Only the citizen of the Reich enjoys full political rights in accordance with the provisions of the law. And then Article 3 says that the Reich Minister of the Interior, in conjunction with the Deputy of the Fuhrer, will issue the necessary legal and administrative decrees for carrying out and supplementing this law. These two laws, collectively called the Enabling Laws, permitted the national political party known as the Nazis to start persecuting the Jewish people. Now, these Nuremberg laws, by their general nature, just formalized the unofficial and the particular measures that they were using against the Jews up to 1935. The Nazi leaders made a point of stressing the consistency of this legislation with the party program, and that demanded that Jews should be deprived of their rights as citizens. Now, although the Jews were being forced out of the country after the Nuremberg laws, the German government began forced deportation of the Jews. Most of the deportations went to Poland. Since the Russian czars had sent many Jews to the Pale, which was in eastern Poland, in the Ukraine, the population of Jews there significantly increased. Now, the Pale started way back with Catherine the Great, where they were forcing Jews out of Russia into this settlement, shtetls, they called them, in this area called the Pale. But during the next 4 years, Hitler enjoyed a succession of domestic and international successes. He outwitted his political rival leaders abroad, and he defeated the opposition at home. In 1935, he abandoned the whole Versailles Treaty and began to build up his army, and he conscripted 5 times the permitted number of men into the armed forces. He persuaded Great Britain to allow an increase in Germany's naval construction program. And in March of 1936, he occupied the demilitarized Rhineland without any opposition. Just moved into it. At the time, the British government was led by very weak liberal people. Very, very weak. Winston Churchill was not in power at that time and continually spoke out against this, and his admonitions fell on deaf ears. Now, one of the first veiled anti-Jewish official attacks on the Jews occurred on November the 8th, 9th, 1938. It's been called Kristallnacht. That's a German word referring to the Night of Broken Glass. It was a program in Nazi Germany against the Jews. On a single night, 91 Jews were murdered and 25,000 to 30,000 were arrested and deported to concentration camps. The Nazis coordinated an attack on Jewish people and their property in Germany and German-controlled lands. It was part of Hitler's anti-Jewish policy. The precipitating event occurred on November the 8th, 1938, when a guy named Herschel Grinspan was 17 years old. He was a German Jew. He was enraged by his family's expulsion from Germany, and he walked into the German embassy in Paris, and he fired 5 shots at a junior diplomat. The guy's name was Ernst von Roth. 2 days later, von Roth died, and Germany was in the grip of a very skillfully orchestrated anti-Jewish violence. The politicians that are evil will wait for a situation like this so that they can bring their military and police force in under the guise of controlling these things. Well, it's hardly controlling them to murder 91 Jews and arrest 25 to 30,000, take them to concentration camps. One guy commits a murder, and this is what they do. In the early hours of November the 10th, there was this orgy of coordinated destruction that broke out in cities, towns, and villages throughout the Third Reich. The consequences of this violence were so bad, disastrous even for the Jews living in the Third Reich. In a single night, Kristallnacht saw the destruction of more than 2,000 synagogues and the ransacking of tens of thousands of Jewish businesses and homes. It marked the beginning of the systematic eradication of a people group in Germany. People can trace their ancestry back to Abraham around 2000 BC and served as a prelude to the Holocaust that was going to follow. Now, Hitler didn't claim any responsibility, although it was fully orchestrated by his chief propaganda man, Joseph Goebbels. Goebbels stated that it was a spontaneous demonstration of the German people in reaction to the news of the murder in Paris. This was the typical Nazi denial of any personal responsibility for any atrocities in Germany directed at the Jews. I'm going to close there, and we'll open this back up with the further development of Germany in 1937 and 1938.